Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Burkina Faso's former president moves to Morocco. The Ebola outbreak ends in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré has gone to Morocco from Ivory Coast, where he initially sought refuge after being ousted 3 weeks ago. Morocco's state news agency reports the former leader arrived in the country late Thursday with five other people. It said he will remain in the country for a fixed-term stay. Sources in northern Nigeria say at least 45 people are dead after suspected Boko Haram militants attacked a village in Borno State. The report says Boko Haram militants stormed the village of Kura in the Mafa region at about noon local time Wednesday and started attacking residents and destroying houses. The militants also carted away food, wares, and livestock. The World Health Organization is declaring an end to the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That outbreak, unrelated to the one affecting West Africa, was centered in Congo's northwestern Equator province and killed at least 49 people. The WHO released a statement today saying it has been 42 days, or twice the maximum incubation period, for a new case of Ebola to be detected in the DRC. Reuters reports that Sudan is asking the joint United Nations African Union peacekeeping mission in western Darfur to leave, according to a senior official. The Sudanese government is at odds with the United Nations concerning allegations of mass rape by Sudanese troops in the area. Sudan denies wrongdoing by its soldiers. A foreign ministry official says he expects the departure to take some time. This is VOA News. Also from Reuters, the International Monetary Fund is reporting progress in a third round of talks on financial aid for Ghana. Increasing inflation, decreasing currency values, and a troubling budget deficit are creating a fiscal crisis for Ghana. Protesters opposing a possible re-election bid by President Faure Gnassingbe today fought with security forces in Togo's capital, Lomé. Police fired tear gas at a crowd marching toward the country's parliament building. The AFP News Service reports that the ruling Patriotic Front Party in Zambia has suspended the membership of acting President Guy Scott for 2 months. Mr. Scott will remain in office. The party accuses him of unconstitutional conduct for allegedly generating favorable media coverage for himself. Legislators working on a new homosexuality law for Uganda say they hope to have a new measure ready for Christmas as a gift to the Ugandan people. Reuters reports that Parliamentary Committee member Abdu Latif Sese Bagala says the measure seeks to criminalize the promotion of homosexuality or the luring of children into homosexual activity. He said a draft of the bill has been completed and will be presented to Parliament for debate. The Associated Press reports Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has signed into law a law calling for life imprisonment for illegal homosexual acts. The AP says the law was signed October 9th, although the government did not announce the signing. The bill was approved by lawmakers in August and was quickly condemned by Western rights organizations. Mr. Jammeh is one of Africa's most vocal opponents of the gay rights movement. The Associated Press reports that a Muslim rights group is warning the Kenyan government that recent raids on mosques may actually hinder a campaign against extremism. The group Muslims for Human Rights says there is growing anger in the Muslim community over the closing of four Mombasa mosques where police reportedly found weapons. Many Muslims believe the police planted the weapons, although the Mombasa police commander rejects that claim. 11 people were killed, many more injured, in a stampede at a Zimbabwean stadium Thursday evening. Thousands of people had been attending a church service at the stadium in Kwekwe. The crowd was trying to leave through the only exit at the facility. Church officials were not immediately available for comment. Police are investigating. U.S. President Barack Obama goes to Las Vegas today to rally public support for his executive order overhauling the country's immigration system. Mr. Obama will hold a campaign-style event aimed at convincing Americans to support the plan which lifts the threat of deportation for millions of illegal immigrants. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The head of the World Health Organization has said the institution will be judged by history for its response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. There has been widespread criticism of the global response to the crisis, with accusations that poor coordination between institutions has cost precious time and resources.
That's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Details next.
Also in the news, Boko Haram militants kill an estimated 45 residents in northern Nigeria.
We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a vigilante group in Nigeria's Borno State says Boko Haram militants have killed an estimated 45 residents of a village in the country's north. A spokesman for the group says militants attacked Azeya Kura on Wednesday and took food and livestock during the shooting. The village is 25 miles from Maiduguri, the birthplace of Boko Haram insurgency. The Nigerian military has been unable to stop rebel attacks on villages and towns in the north. The UN estimates more than 1.5 million Nigerians have been displaced in the violent five-year insurgency.
Eleven worshippers died in a stampede today as thousands tried to leave a church service in Zimbabwe football stadium. Police said around 30,000 were attending the service in a football stadium in Kwekwe, a city 130 miles south of the capital, Harare. Four died in the crush of a crowd trying to leave from a single exit. Seven later died at the hospital.
Authorities in Guinea continue to search for a cooler filled with test tubes of blood, probably containing the Ebola virus. Health officials have initiated a nationwide radial appeal for the safe return of the cooler. They warn that the samples are extremely dangerous. The cooler was among items stolen by roadside bandits from a bus in Kankan Prefecture yesterday. The tubes contained blood samples of patients in the city of Gwekedo who are suspected of being infected with the virus. French President Francois Hollande is scheduled to be the first non-African head of state to visit the Ebola-stricken West African countries since the outbreak began. Hollande said he will visit Ebola centers in Guinea next week. His government has pledged more than $200 million to establish mobile health clinics to counter the Ebola epidemic.
A Cuban doctor who contracted the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone was flown yesterday evening to Geneva, Switzerland, for isolation and treatment. Dr. Felix Baez Sarillo is one of 165 doctors and nurses from Cuba who began working in Ebola treatment centers in Freetown last week. Baez was able to walk off the plane on arrival. The specialized jet service was paid for by the World Health Organization, which contracted for the services of the Cuban health workers. The Spanish health ministry said a healthcare worker is being flown to Madrid from Mali. The ministry said the woman, who worked in a treatment center for Doctors Without Borders, accidentally stuck herself with a needle being used for an Ebola patient. She's being treated as a high-risk patient. The World Health Organization says there have been 15,351 cases of Ebola and 5,459 deaths.
Also, the head of the World Health Organization has said the institution will be judged by history for its response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. There has been widespread criticism of the global response to the crisis, with accusations that poor coordination between institutions has cost precious time and resources. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
A memo from the World Health Organization leaked last month suggested incompetent staff and a lack of information hampered efforts to stop the disease spreading. Questioned on the issue Wednesday, Director General of the WHO, Margaret Chan, acknowledged there were problems.
There will be time for history. and we will review how the whole world, and especially WHO, managed the Ebola outbreak. But at this point in time, it is important for us to focus our entire energy and attention to help countries who are being affected to get the job done.
The Ebola outbreak has laid bare an institution in crisis, says global health policy expert Sophie Harman of Queen Mary University of London.
The World Health Organization should have had a clear leadership role in the Ebola response, but increasingly we see bilateral organizations such as the UK Department for International Development or the US government taking a lead role. Multilaterally, it's really been the World Bank that stepped up in this regard.
The World Bank pledged an extra $100 million last month for the fight against Ebola. Several UN agencies are also involved. Again, Sophie Harman.
We have multiple institutions, but nobody really directing where these energies should be going towards.
The United States has taken on the biggest burden in funding and manpower. The first group of service members from the US Ebola mission returned Tuesday to Texas. Other countries, including China and European states, have faced criticism for their contributions. Barry Johnston is head of advocacy at ActionAid, a charity working in the region.
Unfortunately, the response has been shockingly slow and is still not good enough. We still have seen some of the major global donors, the EU, are not stepping up. And it's only really, and it's worrying, that when it starts to threaten their own doors that they're prepared to respond.
The European Union's Health Commissioner, Vytenis Andriukaitis, visited Sierra Leone this week and called for EU states to do more.
I appeal to the EU member states to encourage health workers and volunteers, especially epidemiologists, to put hesitation and fear aside and go to West Africa and to help fight Ebola now.
Despite the hundreds of millions pledged, campaigners say global efforts to fund the fight against Ebola are being undermined because multinational companies are shifting profits away from West Africa and weakening local economies. Again, Barry Johnston of ActionAid.
ActionAid looked at the three countries affected by the Ebola crisis, Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia, and found that in 2011, the last year that figures are available, those countries actually lost more money to tax avoidance than they were able to spend on their health services.
Analysts say rebuilding those health systems will be the crucial next step for the international community. For now, all efforts are directed at containing the disease. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Egypt has indefinitely closed schools in two border towns in northern Sinai. Reuters reports the school closing come as the army gets ready to battle Islamist militants in the area. The militants have targeted soldiers and police, killing more than 30 in the past month. The Egyptian military has launched airstrikes as well. One militant group has pledged its loyalty to the Islamic State group, which controls large areas of Syria and Iraq.
Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A wave of arrests for homosexuality-related acts has occurred since the Gambia quietly enacted strong anti-gay legislation, making some same-sex acts punishable by life in prison. The bill was signed without fanfare last month by President Yahya Jammeh. The bill is similar to an anti-gay law passed in Uganda that was overturned by a Uganda court on procedural grounds. The bill criminalizes what it calls aggravated homosexuality among serial offenders and people living with HIV or AIDS.
A Ugandan court sentenced five men and women to 4 years in prison for participating in female genital mutilation, or FGM. The accused were arrested in Kapachorwa district last week and pleaded guilty to the charges in a Kampala court. FGM was outlawed in Uganda 4 years ago. There have been dozens of arrests since then, but few prosecutions. Earlier in November, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon launched a global campaign to end the dangerous practice within this generation.
Music. South Africa has announced that as of November 20th, 2014, 1,020 rhinos have been killed by poachers since the beginning of the year. This number has set a new and, according to the government, tragic record, surpassing the 1,004 rhinos killed in all of 2013. The trend has been escalating since 2007, when it was found that 13 rhinos had been poached in South Africa. The African Wildlife Foundation, AWF, has established a $10 million emergency response fund to stop the killing, trafficking, and demand for rhino horn and other wildlife products. Kathleen Garrigan is Senior Communications and Media Relations Officer for the African Wildlife Foundation. She describes why there is such a demand for the rhino horn.
They're believed to cure a number of ailments, anything from cancer to hangovers to fever. And it's a pretty entrenched belief in particular countries, particularly Vietnam, also China and some other Asian countries. So it's a very persistent belief, and it goes back many, many thousands of years. And that's why we're having difficulty really stopping the demand for it, which is driving the poaching on the ground.
How are these illegal sales being made?
It's all very illicit and in the shadows. You usually have a kingpin or a very high-up individual who commissions any number of products. It could be rhino horn, it could be ivory, it could be drugs. You know, usually these criminal syndicates are operating in a number of different areas to make money. There's a whole supply chain of individuals involved, from movers of the product to middlemen to the poacher on the ground. So usually, you know, you have people coming into very impoverished villages, offering a lot of money to these people to go out into a national park or a reserve and shoot a rhino, chop off the horn, bring it back, and then they make sometimes more than a year's salary just in that process. And then as the horn moves along the supply chain, more and more money is exchanging hands.
Your organization, the African Wildlife Foundation, has established an emergency response fund to help stop this killing and trafficking. So what things do you all have in place to stop this?
We have a number of things in place. The emergency response fund allows us to quickly and adeptly sort of maneuver money into those areas where we see we can make the biggest impact the fastest. In terms of stopping the killing, we look at where are there critical populations of rhino on the ground, and we put money and training and expertise into those areas to help protect that particular population of rhino. In terms of stopping the trafficking, stopping the product from getting to market, we have invested in sniffer dogs and dog handlers that are able to be placed at seaports and airports to sniff out wildlife contraband. And then on the stopping the demand side, in Asia, we have joined with a partner, WildAid, to develop very sophisticated, celebrity-driven public service announcements that are aired in Vietnam. We're sort of beating the pavement over in Vietnam, trying to drive attention, inform the public about what's going on in Africa and why their buying habits matter and have a very, very significant impact on rhino populations in Africa.
I also know that you all have a helicopter that is used. How successful is this use of a helicopter?
This is a recent purchase. This is in a private reserve right next to Kruger, which shares a border with Kruger that's unfenced. We have provided some emergency funding to them to enhance their anti-poaching patrols. So Kruger and these private reserves are very vast areas. They only have so many people on the ground. They only have so many resources. So allowing them to sort of get up in the air, really monitor their entire property from the air, and then quickly deploy a team if they see something that doesn't look right on the ground, quickly deploy a team to a very specific area. That's the idea.
Also, you talked about in stopping the demand, you have campaigns there in the countries that people are actually using the rhino horn. So it seems to me that is really a tough challenge there, because you are dealing with something that is very deep-rooted. And it seems to me that's very, very challenging in trying to change someone's viewpoint on a particular thing that they think is working for them.
We're talking about systemic change. We're talking about behavior change, and that definitely takes time. Unfortunately, we don't have that time, which is why we focus on protecting rhinos on the ground and why we work to sort of disrupt the trafficking process. But I think the tactic of using very well-known faces in Vietnam, very well-known faces in China. These are celebrities, these are athletes, these are martial artists who are very much looked up to by the citizens of these countries. They can help us get a message across in a way that we couldn't do on our own. And they are really key to this process. And a recent report in Vietnam did indicate that certain thinking around rhino horn is changing. Now, the demand is still there and it's still quite high, but we're starting to see more and more attention in these countries to these issues, more and more awareness of them. And because it's such an international, global issue with the international community really honed in and focused on this, it's very difficult to not know what's going on.
That was Kathleen Garrigan, Senior Communications and Media Relations Officer for the African Wildlife Foundation. She spoke with me from Washington.
Researchers warned that the world's dry lands are being severely affected by climate change. They say that could harm the livelihoods and food security for billions of people. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Scientists describe the projected effects of climate change on dry lands as alarming. Dr. Jan Rupert is among those raising concerns.
Dry lands cover a rather big amount of the terrestrial land surface, with 40%, a little bit more even. And they are home to approximately 2.5 billion people, of which more or less 1 billion directly live upon rangelands or upon very basic ecosystem services such as fodder to herd animals. They are very important for a huge amount of people.
Rupert is a rangeland ecologist at the University of Cologne. He conducted the research with his university colleague, Dr. Anja Lindstatter, who led the working group.
Drylands are not particularly deserts. Deserts are a part of drylands, but not all drylands are deserts. The main definition of drylands is that they have a scarcity of water, obviously. The transpiration of the water from the soil is higher than the water that comes into the system via precipitation. Actually, if you think of a savanna, that will also be a dryland in most cases.
He says drylands historically have fared pretty well during and after droughts, but they're more at risk now due to the effects of climate change. Human activity, such as raising livestock, can add environmental stress.
Due to climate change, the system is getting even more variable. So the droughts will be more regular and droughts might be even more severe. And this can trigger or can push the systems above a certain tipping point and could lead to degradation. That means a change in the vegetation that cannot be easily recovered from anymore.
He says very severe droughts that usually occur only once every 100 years, may now occur much more often.
The systems not only suffer during a drought, but also need some time to recover after a drought to be fully functional again or to be on the same production level as they have been before the drought. And now if you can imagine that these droughts and even these very severe droughts, centennial scale droughts, come in more often, then we can expect gradual losses from the systems. The systems will not be as reliable as they have been before.
A centennial-scale drought can greatly reduce the production of plant biomass by 45 to more than 70%. Biomass is material from living and recently living plants.
We should also consider how these numbers have been calculated and that they actually only represent single-year drought events. And usually a drought is a multi-year phenomenon, so these numbers are actually even more likely to underestimate the reduction in production because these effects from 1 year to another year, if you have a multi-year drought, might even add up and lead to even more pronounced losses.
Some dry lands could gradually turn to desert, a process called desertification. The rangeland ecologist says the type of plants on dry lands matters. For instance, dry lands with mostly annual plants, which complete their life cycle within 1 year, are more severely affected during droughts, but they recover more quickly afterwards. It's just the opposite when perennial plants, those that come back year after year, are in the majority. Dry lands are also more resistant to animal grazing during droughts when annual plants dominate. Rupert says eliminating grazing is not the answer to protecting dry lands during droughts and during their recovery. Instead, he says, there should be better grazing management, limiting the number of livestock on the land. Also, paying herders higher prices for a time would prevent them from increasing their livestock after a drought. The University of Cologne rangeland ecologist says protecting dry lands is a food security and a livelihood issue. However, he says, it does not get the attention it deserves at climate conferences. The next conference, COP20, opens in Lima, Peru, December 1st. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Obesity costs the global economy as much as smoking or war and terrorism, and exacts a toll greater than that caused by alcoholism. Those conclusions are contained in a new report that found the cost of obesity worldwide is $2 trillion. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The price tag in healthcare costs and missed work days as a result of overweight and obesity is estimated to hover around 2.8% of the yearly global economy. According to the report by the McKinsey Global Institute, more than 2 billion people, roughly one-third of the world's population, are overweight or obese, and by 2030, the percentage will grow to nearly half. Excess kilos are responsible for 5% of all deaths worldwide, the Institute concluded. Children as well as adults suffer from weight problems. Diane Hess is a childhood obesity specialist in New York and a member of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. Hess says 80% of fat kids become overweight and obese adults. She blames the easy availability of fast, cheap, calorie-rich food for the obesity epidemic.
I work in New York City, where you walk into a waiting room in any pediatric hospital and you look around the waiting room and the kids are eating, you know, Doritos and chips in a bag, and some of the babies have fruit punch in their bottles.
Experts determine whether someone is obese by calculating their body weight index, or BMI, dividing the person's weight in kilograms by the square of their height in meters. An individual who has a BMI greater than 25 is considered overweight, and a BMI of between 30 and 40 is considered obese by doctors. The report names 44 interventions to help counter the obesity epidemic, including public health campaigns, calorie content labels, and making healthy school meals. Hess says intervention begins with education about proper nutrition at an early age, pointing to things families can do to keep the kilos off.
It's education in the home, it's getting people moving, going to walk after dinner, parking. If you're going to the shopping mall, parking the furthest instead of the closest to the store, getting off one bus stop or subway stop earlier. I mean, even in the airports, they have people movers. People don't walk anymore.
Experts are calling on governments, healthcare systems, soft drink manufacturers, and food vendors to develop a coordinated response to the weight crisis. No single intervention is seen as enough to combat the excess weight epidemic. But the new report concludes that several measures taken together will help tackle the problem. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Boko Haram militants kill an estimated 45 residents in northern Nigeria. And authorities in Guinea continue to search for a cooler filled with test tubes of blood, probably containing the Ebola virus. Coming up, we have music from the DRC. And in our feature segment, the ongoing fight to contain the Ebola epidemic. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. And happy Friday, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Kim. Joining us once again on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, the field is now set for the 16-team Africa Cup of Nations finals after a recent qualifying competition. We'll go group by group, David, and get your analysis. But first, as I look at the 16 qualified teams, 9 former champions that will be competing in Equatorial Guinea beginning in January. However, the reigning African champion Super Eagles of Nigeria, not among them. Let's begin with Group A, David. South Africa tops the table with 12 points, followed by Congo Brazzaville with 10, Nigeria with 8, and Sudan with 3. Your thoughts?
Sonny, there's just one word to sum up Group A: crazy. I mean, Congo, they lose at home to South Africa, they lose at home to Nigeria, and they still qualify. And Nigeria, who I believe everybody in Africa from Cairo to Cape Town expected to win this group with the other 3 countries battling for second place, they did have a great chance. They were at home to the team that they always seem to beat, South Africa, in their final match, but could only manage a 2-2 draw against a South African team that played the last 20 minutes with 10 players, and also a South African team that led 2-0 after 49 minutes. 2 goals from the new star of Bafana, Tokelo Ranti. He plays for Bournemouth in the English Championship, which is effectively their second division. And he scored a great goal. Vincent Inyama, to me, is the best goalkeeper in Africa. And Ranti hammered the ball past him just before halftime to give Bafana the lead. To the credit of Nigeria, they did fight back. They didn't give up. And a substitute, Aluko, he scored twice. The second goal, 4 minutes into stoppage time. That still would have been enough for Nigeria if Congo Brazzaville did not win in Sudan. But they did. They won 1-0. So as you said, Sonny, South Africa 2 points ahead of Congo and Congo 2 points ahead of Nigeria. But truly crazy form. And now, of course, the big question, as always, will be what about the future of Stephen Keshi? He's been hired, fired, hired, fired, and hired again. This can't go on. There has to be some sort of certainty. I must say, at the final whistle, Sonny, in Uyo, in that magnificent stadium in the south of Nigeria, Keshi looked a little bit lost. He looked like a rabbit in the headlights. My guess is that he will go, and I think Nigeria will turn to a European coach. But what's sad is that the momentum built by Nigeria by winning the 2013 Nations Cup and then doing reasonably well, they did get to the second round of the World Cup in Brazil, I feel that's going to be lost now. And when the new man comes in, assuming they make a change, it's basically starting all over again.
Turning to Group B, David, the Desert Foxes of Algeria, very impressive at this year's World Cup, topped the table with 15 points from 6 matches. That was the highest tally of any African team in the qualifying competition. Mali makes it to Equatorial Guinea. They have 9 points in the table. And Malawi and Ethiopia with 7 and 4 points, respectively. Your thoughts on this group, David?
Going into the final matches, Sonny, Algeria, as you said, they had done the job. They had easily qualified. And so it was all about who was going to finish second. And Mali, after two consecutive defeats, they must have been worried by the visit of the desert foxes, but they finally found some of the form that we've learned to expect from the Malians, third in the last two Cup of Nations. And a goal from Seydou Keita, their star midfielder in the first half, set them up for a 2-0 win over the Algerians. And that basically put pay to any chance Malawi or Ethiopia had of snatching the second place. The Algerian Sunny, the most impressive African team in Brazil at the World Cup, taking the eventual champions Germany to extra time in the second round, they, I guess, are going to be many people's early favourites to win the 2015 Cup of Nations, and they certainly have been impressive. And they're no longer relying exclusively on Feghouli, the Valencia wide midfielder. They have found a new star in Yassine Brahimi. He plays for Porto in Portugal. He scored three of the qualifying goals, and he's looking very impressive indeed. So this Algerian side are growing as time goes by. And while I wouldn't make them favourites yet, they're certainly going to be one of the favourites come Equatorial Guinea next January.
Turning to Group C, David, Gabon and Burkina Faso win the tickets to Equatorial Guinea. Gabon, the 2012 Nations Cup co-host with Equatorial Guinea, tops the table with 12 points, followed by Burkina Faso with 11, Angola and Lesotho with 6 points and 2 points, respectively. How do you see that group, David?
Yes, honey, this was a group dominated from the start by Burkina Faso and Gabon. The expected challenge from Angola never materialized. They lost their opening two matches. While Lesotho were always going to be up against it, they were very much the minnows of this group, and in fact had done really well to beat Liberia and Kenya to get to the group phase. And so the question going into the final rounds was really an academic one. Who is going to finish top between Gabon and Burkina Faso? And in the end, Gabon shaded it by 1 point by beating Lesotho 4-2 in Libreville, while Burkina Faso, who've gone off the boil a little bit recently, they remember hammered Angola 3-0 in Luanda. That was the performance of Group C, in my opinion. But they could only draw 1-1 at home with the Angolans, so they have to settle for second place. But it is academic, Sonny. I want to stress that. Finishing first or second will have no influence over the seedings. That is done on the performances in previous Africa Cup of Nations tournament finals. So academic to some extent, but I suppose it's always good psychologically. It's a morale boost. We did finish top of the group, and in this case, it was the Panthers from Gabon who topped Group C by 1 point from the Stallions of Burkina Faso.
In Group D, David, the indomitable Lions of Cameroon, after a very disappointing World Cup performance in Brazil, where they lost all three of their matches, they bounced back with, I think, one of the better Nations Cup campaigns. They topped the table with 14 points from 6 qualifiers. The Elephants of Ivory Coast also advanced to Equatorial Guinea with 10 points. The Democratic Republic of Congo makes it to Equatorial Guinea as the best third-place team. The DR Congo with 9 points, and at the very bottom, Sierra Leone, racked by the Ebola crisis with only 1 point. Your thoughts on Group D, David?
Yes, Sonny, you make a good point about Cameroon. Normally, I like to praise players rather than coaches, but in this case, I'm going to make an exception and say well done to Volker Fink, the German. After that utterly disastrous World Cup where everything went wrong on and off the field, it was just shambolic. Who would have blamed that 65-year-old if he'd said, enough is enough, I'm going home to Germany, I don't need this in my life? But he stuck it out. Many people thought he was crazy. And he's been rewarded, Sonny. Cameroon unbeaten in one of the toughest groups. But sadly, a rather farcical end to their match against the Ivory Coast in Abidjan, which ended goalless. What happened is, with 3 minutes of stoppage time looming, the Ivorians decided to play keep ball in their own half of the field, kept passing it among themselves, passing it back to the goalkeeper. I was also very disappointed with the Cameroonians. They made no attempt to come over the halfway line into the Ivorian half and challenge for the ball. Now, Africans were very, very angry and upset. Way back in 1982, when a similar situation developed in a World Cup match between Austria and Germany. They just went through the motions, and that meant that Algeria failed to make it to the knockout stages. But now, right here in the Félix Houphouët-Boigny Stadium in Abidjan, we had something that African football does not need. And this nonsense went on for about 4 minutes before the referee, thankfully, blew the final whistle. But is this what Ivorian football has been reduced to? This is a side that have been favourites to win the last five Cup of Nations titles. And here they are, afraid to attack Cameroon with 4 minutes left, afraid to go and try and score the winning goal because they feared perhaps that they would concede a goal. And that doesn't all go well for their future, Sonny, of the elephant in this competition. And also congratulations to the Democratic Republic of Congo, a very up-and-down tournament. They lost two of their first three home games, and then they won two of their first three away games. And then in this crucial final game against Sierra Leone, which I always had a feeling could well decide who finishes in the best third place, they fell behind in the first half, but came back strongly in Kinshasa to win by 3-1. And it's been a pretty good year for DR Congo, with Vita Club reaching the final of the CAF Champions League. And I believe they will be competitive in Equatorial Guinea in January.
David, you mentioned Volker Fink, Cameroon's German coach. How important was it that he gave the boot to Samuel Eto'o, Cameroon's four-time African Footballer of the Year, before this Nations Cup qualifying campaign began?
Oh, I think it was very important, Sonny. I fully acknowledge all the great things Samuel Eto'o has done for African football, for Cameroon, and for the various clubs in Europe he's played for. But he's very much a mixed bag. He comes with skill, but he also comes with problems. And in recent years, I think Samuel Eto'o has been a big part of the problem of Cameroon football. And to the credit of Fink, who obviously had to be very brave to make this decision, he decided that he had to turn things around. And he's been rewarded.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And we'll hear more Nations Cup commentary from David next week.
VOA!
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the ongoing fight to contain the Ebola epidemic. And next, Angola's government tightening the noose around free expression. But first, some music. Here is Tabule of the DRC with Paquita.
Volvas pronto, Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi, Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto, Paquita, para bien, que tu madre te garda, oh, esto es tu espera, quiero que creces pronto, Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi, Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Estoy herido por la flecha de tu belleza y disimulo. Venosen de mi corazón, está pronto, bella Paquita. Paquita, gracias, gracias, tu clava es mi. Paquita, fidele yo, que volvas pronto. Paquita,
gracias, gracias, tu clama es mi paguita, pídele yo que volvas pronto.
DRC's Tabuli with Paquita.
Although the Ebola crisis may have abated somewhat, the fight to contain the epidemic and help its victims continues in West Africa. At a press conference in New York, Nicole Walden of the International Rescue Committee offered an update on the fight against Ebola. The IRC helps people whose lives and livelihoods are shattered by disaster to recover and gain control of their futures. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York City.
In the U.S. government's Foreign Press Center next to the United Nations, Nicole Walden told reporters about the IRC's multi-pronged efforts to fight Ebola in Liberia.
It has ranged from investigating cases to identifying contacts that may have interacted with infected individuals and tracing those individuals for the 21-day incubation period. We've supported the establishment of infection prevention and control mechanisms within the health facilities around the country.
Walden explained that most of Liberia's health facilities closed when the epidemic began to rage out of control earlier this year.
People were too afraid. The health workers themselves had no confidence in their ability to keep themselves safe. And so health services have basically ceased to exist in the form of malaria or antenatal support, pneumonia until very recently. A number of health facilities' doors have reopened because of the support provided in training healthcare workers how to keep themselves safe.
Powerful clashes between traditional African culture and Western epidemiology have complicated fighting Ebola. In African culture, a corpse is handled by many loving hands before it is buried. But health workers know that direct contact with fluids from an infected body spreads the virus.
In the county where Monrovia sits, a couple of months ago, the situation was at such a critical level that it was decided to stop burials and make mandatory cremation for all dead bodies. This was extremely, extremely unpopular, disconcerting for families. It flies in the face of every cultural norm and tradition that people have. While some communities, you could get them on board with the science of it, but couldn't reconcile the emotion of it. We are exploring all options. How could we go back to burial practice? Where is a safe location? How can we make sure that safe burials can be possible again? I think that will be happening imminently.
When asked whether the outbreak in Liberia may be getting under control, Walden offered a measured response. She said transmission rates do seem to be declining, but warned against complacency.
I think we're in a place now where this is far, far beyond a public health crisis. This is affecting every aspect of life, from the economy. Schools are closed. No education is happening. People are struggling to find jobs and don't have access to other types of health services. So people are affected. Their mental health, their social and emotional well-being and care is really starting to get highlighted as part of the response, something that hasn't been given enough attention to date. We need to redouble our efforts, not only in thinking about the medical activities and interventions that need to take place, but a really holistic way of looking at the new normal.
Containment and treatment clinics paid for by the United States and its allies continue to be built in Liberia and other West African nations where the epidemic is most severe. Meanwhile, Ebola-related deaths continue, especially in remote rural areas where access even to rudimentary health care is scarce to non-existent. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Angola's government is tightening the noose around the free expression, says a top Angolan journalist. His charges are backed by an international rights watchdog. The journalist is blogger Rafael Marquez de Moria in Johannesburg. VOA's Anita Powell listened to the harrowing experiences of the Angolan journalist and brings us this report.
Angolan journalist Rafael Marquez de Moraes was last arrested in 2013. The veteran reporter was covering a court case for his anti-corruption website Maka Angola and trying to interview two of the defendants outside the courthouse in Luanda. He describes that experience.
What was striking was not the stomping on the back I received directly from the commander of this special police unit. It was not the severe blow with a baton to the back of my neck. It was not even the fact that the police filmed us being abused at the headquarters of this infamous unit for the pleasure of their superiors. What was striking to me was the ability of the judicial system to execute such a robbery of justice.
Since his first arrest in 1999 as a newspaper reporter, Marquez has flirted with danger in a nation that rights groups say is getting increasingly repressive. His critics say he has sown dissent and defamed the government by alleging corruption and calling the nation's leader of 35 years a dictator, a charge for which he was tried, sentenced to 6 months in prison, and ordered to pay damages directly to the president. At Maka Angola, he continues to focus on what he says are two of the most important stories in his southern African nation, corruption and human rights abuses. He's still in the hot seat, he told hundreds of academics, journalists, and students who came to hear him speak at Johannesburg's University of the Witwatersrand. He says some of the generals are seeking more than $1 million in damages over his reports on human rights abuses. The Committee to Protect Journalists has documented numerous instances of arrest, intimidation, and killings of journalists in Angola. Since 1992, the year Marquez joined the state-owned Journal de Angola, 10 journalists have been killed on the job, and the CPJ classifies 7 of those deaths as murder. VOA News' parent organization, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, says 4 VOA journalists have been targeted by authorities since 2006. New York-based Human Rights Watch has also documented increasing repression in Angola. HRW Southern Africa Director Tiseke Kasambala says the government has not just stifled the press, but also anyone who protests against the government in any form. Angolan authorities have said in public forums, most recently at a United Nations review of the human rights record, that the government respects free speech and allows protests. And Marquez says the government has used him as part of their argument.
Members of the regime are not shy about saying that the fact that I am alive and still doing my work is evidence of democracy in Angola and the magnanimity of the president.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhid in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Richard Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 21 Pacific Rim economies that comprise the membership of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC Forum, are home to approximately 40% of the world's population and three-fifths of the global economy. And over the next 5 years, half of all economic growth outside of the United States will take place in APEC countries. In the 21st century, said President Barack Obama at a recent APEC CEO summit, one country's prosperity doesn't have to come at the expense of another. If we work together and act together, strengthening the economic ties between our nations will benefit all of our nations. That's true for the nations of APEC, and I believe it's particularly true for the relationship between the United States and China. The United States welcomes the rise of a prosperous, peaceful, and stable China. In fact, we help China integrate into the global economy. That's because, even though we do compete for business, we believe China's participation in the rules-based international economic system enables us to work together on global challenges, promotes more open and market-driven bilateral and international trade and investment, and is ultimately good for our own economy. We hope to persuade China to take specific actions that will help expand trade and investment across the Asia-Pacific, including pursuing a high-standard and comprehensive bilateral investment treaty that embodies the principles of non-discrimination, fairness, openness, and transparency. Said President Obama,
"We look to China to create a more level playing field on which foreign companies are treated fairly so that they can compete fairly with Chinese companies. A playing field where competition policy promotes the welfare of consumers and doesn't benefit just one set of companies over another. We look to China to become an innovative economy that values the protection of intellectual property rights and rejects cyber theft of trade secrets for commercial gain. We look to China to approve biotechnology advances that are critical to feeding a growing planet on the same timeline as other countries. To move definitively towards a more market-determined exchange rate. And yes, to stand up for human rights and freedom of the press."
Such actions would be good for the United States, good for sustainable growth in China, and good for the stability of the Asia-Pacific region. "We are the two largest economies in the world," said President Obama. "If China and the United States can work together, the world benefits."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. 1st, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately, because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.